Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest is Emily Carney. She's a journalist, a former nuclear technician for the Navy, a co-host of the Space and Things podcast, and founder of the Space Hipsters Spaceflight Group. She's with me today because she's also the author, with Bruce McCandless, of a new book titled Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, from Goddard's rockets to Goldilocks planets and everything in between. Emily, welcome to the program and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let me just start with a really basic question about the public, really, and that is, what's, in your opinion, what is the biggest misconception that people have about either space or space exploration?
I think the biggest misconception, and we'll probably get back to this later in the interview as well, but I think the biggest misconception about spaceflight is that it doesn't really have any worth for Earth. Because when people think about spaceflight, they always think about, oh, it's stuff that's happening up there. What's it doing for us down here? And it's done an incredible amount for our day-to-day lives, but it's also, there is a potential in the future to have an off-planet civilization, and it's teaching us how to do that as well. I tend to think very long term. So I think that's why, you know, space is worthwhile. And I think that's a big misconception, you know, when you ask just regular people about space, well, what is it doing for me down here? It's actually doing a lot in your day-to-day life, down to the medicines you might take. So I think, and some of the technologies we have, I mean, heck, we have a little microprocessor right here, you know, at our fingertips. And that's a lot of that is from spaceflight technology. And, but you, when you talk to people, you got to make it more than just spinoffs. You got to, you know, and my thing is, it, in the future, you know, it may be useful to have off planet habitation, you know, and most people don't want it. Most people like that's crazy. But I'm like, I'm talking about 100, 200 years from now. So I think, I really think those are the things that make space flight worth it. And also just having something to be wondrous about. That's the thing. That's what got me into space flight was just the sheer like, wow, you know, the amazement in it, you know, and the fact that, you know, you could take people from zero to 17,500 miles per hour and like less than 10 minutes and put them in orbit to me is just, that's always, you want to say the word miracle comes up. It's not a miracle. It's a lot of hard work, but it just seems miraculous.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I do want to get into a couple of those topics. So you've already anticipated that. We'll come back to a couple of them, but let me ask you this as sort of a starting point in thinking about the history of the story of humans in space. What do you think, if there is one, is the single most important inflection point in that story? You know, where does the thing really turn?
I think the inflection point really, this is my opinion. Some other space historians may not agree with me, and that's fine. My personal inflection point would probably be around 1966, because that was the point where we had it's been called the space race between the Soviet Unions and the US. And that was really the point where things started. And granted, I'm not, you know, trying to strike out some of the bad things that NASA went through shortly after that. But I think that was the point where we really started to turn a corner and hold our own, and where it really seemed like, wow, we might make it to the moon, you know, because we had the Gemini program. It was demonstrating a lot of the concepts the United States needed to ace before we got to the moon, you know, pretty effectively. You know, Apollo was being developed. Granted, it had some serious issues at the time, you know, and it really seemed, you know, and at that time, the Soviet Union, they weren't really doing anything. They kind of went quiet for a little bit. Mm. So that to me really seems like the turning point in the story, like, wow, we might actually make this goal that, you know, Kennedy set for us. So, yeah, a lot of people would say the moon landing and stuff like that, or something else. And that's fine. But that's just my opinion. You know, if you want to take it back even earlier of, OK, this is where things begin to pivot a little bit in our direction. Like, wow, it looks like we might actually make it. So that's my opinion.
Well, yeah, and I it's interesting that you mention that, because I did want to ask you a couple questions about the Apollo program and also the more general effort to go to the moon. I've read a fair number of analyses of the Kennedy administration, and it's clear from those that both Kennedy and his closest advisors were extremely pragmatic and even somewhat cautious in a lot of ways, despite the afterglow that we have about his administration. I was wondering, where did Kennedy get the idea of dedicating us to putting a man on the moon by 1970? That was a bold claim when he made it.
That's a great question. I honestly wondered that in a lot of ways myself. That's a really great question. I'm not sure if I can even answer that. I think Kennedy was just, he was trying to motivate our country to a certain goal, you know. Uh-huh. He was trying to motivate us to a means to an end. That speech at Rice University in many ways was a surprise to people at NASA, because they listened to the speech. Ellen Shepard just got back from space in May 1961, right? First American in space. You know, the Soviets did beat us to the punch a bit, but, you know, Freedom 7 was a much needed success for us, because we'd had a lot of public failures. And we'd only had 15 minutes, roughly, in space. Maybe, you know, if you want to stretch it out, maybe 18 minutes. That speech that Kennedy gave, and like you said, Kennedy, I think, had a lot of mixed feelings towards spaceflight. If you look at a lot of his private papers and some of his private communications, he didn't always come across as like pro space, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think he wanted to give us a sort of a bold motivation, you know, for the country, you know, to technologically. A lot of people at NASA at the time were like, what? Like, we got to do what? Because, you know, this, any effort to go to the moon, it required obviously propulsion, which we did not have at the time. We didn't have the Saturn V in 1961. It involved hardware which had not yet been invented. It required just a lot of things that we just didn't have yet. So I think, you know, Kennedy just wanted to give the country something bold to strive toward, you know, and sort of a, I guess, a shared experience, you know. Mm. And when he died, you know, when he was unfortunately assassinated in December 1963, I think it became even more important to people at NASA to fulfill that wish, because it was something that, okay, this is, it became more poignant, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I'm probably skipping a lot of historical documents. I'm not sure what was the actual pivot in his mind for it, but I think it came as a surprise to a lot of people, especially at NASA, because they're like, we just finished a 15-minute long flight. We haven't even flown in Earth orbit yet, and you want us to go to the moon.
Be a juxtaposition with some of his other caution and public policy areas. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with space journalist Emily Carney, co-author with Bruce McCandless of a new book titled Starbound. Well, I want to fast forward now to more to the present. And it strikes me, as I read in the last few years, that most of the space-related press has seemed to focus on the privately funded or non-governmental space efforts. So first question is, how significant have those efforts been for space exploration and for keeping the space-related efforts going? Is the private sector now terribly important to that?
Absolutely. We've seen in the last decade or so, you know, we've got companies like Blue Origin sending private citizens to space. We have, obviously, SpaceX has really kind of monopolized the satellite market, the small sat market. They're developing Starship for deep space exploration. They also have the Falcon Heavy as well. There's obviously, you know, Virgin Galactic, things of that nature as well. Really, Over a decade ago, NASA entered into a commercial crew partnership with a few vendors, such as Boeing. I won't get into Starliner too much, and SpaceX to send cargo and crew to the International Space Station. And really, since that point, SpaceX has proved themselves as a company to be very capable in meeting a lot of the goals for cargo, putting crew up there. Since 2020, we've had a ton of crew sent to the ISS using the Crew Dragon. So yeah, commercial space flight is in the last decade or so has just, exploded. It's just gotten huge. When people think about space flight in the future, they're probably going to associate this era with commercial space flight, I think, because NASA, and that's not a slight to NASA at all. NASA has been working for a very long time to develop the Space Launch System and to develop infrastructure for Orion. And granted, they've worked with some contractors for that, but in the meantime, the bulk of human spaceflight has been carried out by, SpaceX. So yeah, absolutely, this is sort of the era for commercial spaceflight, for private and public partnerships, and also just for private spaceflight. We've seen Inspiration 4 sent up 4 private astronauts, Polaris Dawn sent up 4 private astronauts, and they accomplished an EVA, the first private spacecraft EVA, which is a huge deal, which means that,
And
not an average.
just translate EVA for our listeners.
Oh, okay. Extra vehicle, a spacewalk, extra vehicle
Okay.
activity. Basically, a spacewalk. But
Right.
granted, it wasn't a very ambitious spacewalk. All they did was go out of the spacecraft and stand up and test the suit. It wasn't like they were doing very complex tasks. That's still a huge deal because you got to start somewhere. And that means in the future, regular astronauts will have the capability to maybe fix infrastructure in space, So this is definitely the era of those kind of things.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Emily Carney. The journalist and former nuclear technician is the co-author with Bruce McCandless of a new book titled Starbound: A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program, From Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between. And we've been discussing her book. So you mentioned this at the outset, Emily, and I wanted to come back to it because I think it is such an important question. I'm going to give it some personal context if I could, but it goes back to the question of the expense of space exploration and space research versus tangible rewards. And I remember as a boy, I watched Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk on the moon in real time. And it was an amazing experience for me. But recently, I watched a movie about Neil Armstrong called First Man. And I was surprised watching the movie to learn that there was a lot of political controversy at the time about spending that amount of money on going to the moon. And I suppose I get that in one way, but the entire world was mesmerized. You mentioned sort of the wonder of all this, and I can remember that. I mean, if I put it this way, this is not an exaggeration. If I'm on my deathbed and I'm still of coherent mind, and somebody asks me, what were the biggest things that you saw in your lifetime? The first thing coming out of my mouth is going to be, I watched a man walk on the moon. And so I guess what this all leads to is what do you say to people when they question the value of a dedicated space program in those kind of financial terms?
That's a really great question. I did love in First Man how they sort of juxtaposed the Apollo 11, the moon landing, with some of the social concerns of the time,
Right.
especially some of the cultural concerns that were going on at the time. You had race issues, there were riots, people were protesting a lot of unseemly things that were happening with the government, etc. Fast forward to now, we have a lot of the same things that are still happening. I won't try to get too political here, but let's look at right now in this time in history. We've got a new administration about to come in. We have a lot of the same social problems and issues that we had during the late 1960s. Unfortunately, they're still around. and you know, and in the last few weeks, I've seen a lot of posts on the internet, you know, and on various social media, like, you know, why do we need, you know, space flight? Why do we need space flight? Well, we need, you know, we need women's rights. We need healthcare. And I completely agree with that. I think we do need, you know, we do need to pay attention to what's going on here as well. I do think, though, I think space flight is 100% worth it. The reasons why is I do think advances in spaceflight, especially public and cultural advances, like, for example, Artemis 2 is supposed to send the first African-American, the first woman, and the first Canadian around the moon. Granted, that's not an American accomplishment, but that still means something. You know, that's been a long time coming. When we think of people going to the moon culturally, what do we think of? We think of people like Neil Armstrong. I love Neil Armstrong, but he was the sort of the archetypical white male middle-class test pilot, you know? In the late 60s, we didn't have women going to the moon. We didn't have African-Americans. We didn't have people from other nations allowed to go to the, you know, to go to the moon. Now we're going to see that for the first time. That's just, to me, that has a lot of cultural importance. Many people probably don't agree with me. They're probably like, what big deal is this? To me, that is a huge deal. I do believe representation in our society is extremely important. For me, it was extremely important growing up. This is probably a very long, convoluted answer, but when I was growing up, the first women astronauts were coming up at NASA, you know, such as Judy Resnick and Sally Ride, Ray Seddon, Anna Fisher, et cetera, et cetera. And seeing those women in space literature just killing it, you know, just doing incredible work in spaceflight, that to me was like, whoa, that somebody like me could do that someday, you know, and that really, I think if I hadn't seen that, I wouldn't have gotten into this industry. I really believe that. Because I wasn't, you know, as much as I like, as I admire the male Apollo astronauts, and I've been fortunate to become friendly with some of them, there wouldn't have been that representation for somebody like me where I could see myself doing something like that, you know, whereas with women, it was like, wow, I have a place in this industry. So I think representation is important. I'm sure a lot of people, again, will disagree with what I say, but I stand by what I say. I think that's very important for just our culture in the world as a whole. I do think it has financial, like I said, I think it has very useful spinoffs technologically as well. And I think it's important because one day, maybe not in the next few years, but maybe 100, 200 years from now, we may need to maintain an off-planet presence.
I want to come back to that. I want to come back to that. But you mentioned the climate today, and I did want to ask you a question about that. Former president and now president-elect Trump, as I recall, he started the Space Force, sixth branch of the armed forces. It received some criticism, even some ridicule at the time. What impact has it had so far?
Well, the Space Force has had, I believe it was derived from the Air Force that already existed at the time. I do believe it's had, I know a few people who are in the Space Force. The Space Force runs a lot of the, what used to be Air Force bases, but a lot of the space infrastructure at Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg. I'm former military. At the time, you know, the idea of a Space Force was really met with ridicule and their uniforms got made fun of and stuff. I personally don't, as ex-military, I would never make fun of that. Personally, I think that's, for me, that's verboten. I think the Space Force does have a positive impact every day because they maintain a lot of day-to-day space operations, such as, you know, Cape Canaveral, Vandenberg, and things like that. So that's really what I think about it. I'm, as ex-military, I'm really loath to poo-poo on any other military branch unless it's Army, Navy, game day.
Yeah, I've heard a few of those from other folks.
Yeah. Unless certain days, on certain days of the
Certain
year,
days.
we're not friends. But the rest of the year, we're okay. We're fine.
We're okay. That's right. If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the journalist Emily Carney, whose new book is titled Starbound. So I want to come back to something that you mentioned earlier, and you've talked about a couple times, habitation and space. I get the sense from what you're saying then that's probably the distant frontier in space exploration, space research. But I was also wondering, this is a very abstract question, but do you think there is some kind of limit on what humans can achieve in and through space? Maybe like a space ceiling, if that makes sense, that you, as someone who thinks in very long term terms, would identify?
That's an amazing question. I've thought about that a lot myself. Again, most people would probably not agree with my answer. I don't think there is a ceiling. I think it's going to take a lot of time to reach certain milestones. I think permanent space habitation, that's something that, that's an idea that's been around for a very long time. Space settlements were something that were first discussed, gosh, in the 1970s, late 60s. There were a lot of visionary thinkers who discussed those back in the day, and that idea is very still much bandied about. I think those are very, on a smaller scale, I think those are very possible. They could definitely happen. We do have the technology for those kinds of things in the future. A lot of people want to talk about Mars. They want to go to Mars. And I have mixed feelings about Mars. I think going to Mars for long-term trips, I think it's possible. There are a lot of variables that need to be worked out for human survivability. You know, obviously we can't breathe the atmosphere on Mars. Landing is very difficult on Mars. It's not like landing on the moon or on Earth. There is a radiation issue on Mars, you know, and yeah, it would suck to go to Mars and then you come back and you get cancer. You know, nobody wants that. Nobody wants that kind of experience, you know, and you know, people generally don't want to see astronauts go through that, you know, and so that's kind of, you know, a safety mitigation issue there. I think those things are, I do think Mars as a goal is possible in the future. I just think there are a ton of issues that need to be sort of at least looked into before we attempt something like that. And there are a lot of thinkers who would disagree with me just because they're like, oh yeah, we could do it. We could do it now. Just send up some terraforming stuff, make some, you know, they think it's going to be like The Martian, and that's an awesome idea. I love The Martian. I love Andy Weir. I think that's a cool idea. And I love the idea of exploring deep space like that. But, you know, like I said, as somebody who worked in the nuclear Navy, I have some basic knowledge of what radiation does to people. And my concern is, you know, we don't want to see people get nuked to death on another planet. You know, you just don't want to see that. So those are things that, and shielding can be very heavy. The shielding we use on Earth for like reactor plants is like lead, basically. You can't take that into space. That's very heavy. It's not really a good space material. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I wanted to leave. We got about 3 minutes or so, and I wanted to have some fun at the end with you, with some quirky questions. So, for each of these, you got about a minute or so to explain your answer if you want. But it's kind of like a lightning round, if you will. The first one is, because you have so much experience with this. First one is, what's your favorite movie or TV show that features space?
For All Mankind on Apple TV.
And what is so special about that? Quickly.
It just feels, it is far-fetched, but it feels, when you're watching it, it feels so real in the moment. Like you can actually feel like it's really, you can feel like it's really happening. Like it's incredible. I just love it. My favorite season, I think, was it season two? It was when they were in the 1980s. Not the happiest season, but definitely I was like, wow, this show is incredible. You feel like you're present there in the moment. I love it.
For Mankind, it's called.
For All Mankind. Yep.
For All Mankind. For All Mankind.
On Apple TV.
I haven't seen that one. I'll have to check it out. Yeah. Okay. So my next one is, what about a favorite novel that is about space or features space in some way?
Oh, wow. I read so much nonfiction about space. It's hard to talk about fictional books. There was a book. God, this is a kind of a trashy one. The Cape by Martin Caden. Martin Caden wrote a lot of space books. He was kind of a big personality in Cape Canaveral. But he wrote a book called The Cape, and it's sort of about sabotage at, Cape Kennedy. And it's just, it's kind of trashy in some parts, but I love it. If you want to sort of get a sense of what 1960s, early 1970s, Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy was like, just read that book. It's a really cool time capsule. I love that era. So it's a neat book. There's a few other books like by James Michener, Space. I haven't gotten through the whole book, but I liked it. I liked what I read. So those are probably my top two fictional ones.
Interesting. Okay. And then last is, and this one may be the toughest one for you. We've got about a minute left. What about a song that's about space or space travel? What's your favorite song in this regard?
Moon Age Daydream by David Bowie. Most people are like, oh, Space Oddity. I'm like,
right,
no.
Right.
Moon Age Daydream is the song for me. That song is my favorite. I love it. That song is incredible. It's just, and it's also used in For All Mankind to great effect in the first season. So I love it. That's my favorite space song.
You've made two sales with me here today, in addition to your book, which I already have, and that is checking out that For All Mankind. And now I got to check out that new Bowie song, because I was sure that you were going to say either Space Oddity or Rocket Man. So yeah. You surprised me there. That was fantastic. Well, that was Emily Carney. And again, her new book is titled Starbound, A Beginner's Guide to the American Space Program from Goddard's Rockets to Goldilocks Planets and Everything in Between. It's a great story, and it's about something terribly important in our history. So, Emily, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Have a great day. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure talking to you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. The program is edited by Mark Livonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.